Greetings to the crew, all those who participate in the Gaian navigation experiment, and to anyone else who cares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, speaking on the 23rd of February, 2012. And this recording is to accompany crew notes number 16 in our ongoing adventure. And the title of this talk, as well as those notes, is Initial Conditions of the Divine Experiment. Now, those of you who've been on board since the beginning of this experiment, in summer of last year, or who have joined since that time, will recall an extremely important factor in the method that I pursue and the method that you are learning. This is the mythogenetic method, which uses simultaneously the first and second attention, that is to say, your power for rational thought and for cognitive coherence, if you will, for intellectual coherence and scrutiny, reasoning, combined with directed imagination. The actual tools of this method are the lunar apsides, that is, the apogee or far point and the perigee or near point of the moon, which correspond to the second and first attention, respectively. So by observing the movements and the timing of these lunar apsides each month, I can chart a course, specifically the course of events on the planetary scale as well as on the within the collective psyche of humanity and in your own individual psyches, the course of events that describe the correction of the wisdom goddess. So I pointed out early in the experiment that my role as a navigator would involve me in charting this course, which is not a predictive process. As I've said before, if I tell the crew that around 4 o'clock in the afternoon next Sunday we're going to pass a certain coral reef, that's not a prediction. I'm not picking that out of the sky like some Old Testament prophet. That is just a result of my knowledge of the sea, of the winds, of the navigational process, and it's my best estimate of when our course, in this case, the journey of the mothership, will take us along a certain trajectory, will take us in a certain direction where we will meet certain conditions. So this is what I'm doing. It's empirical, it's voracious, it can be tested. And many of you who are following this will recall my commitment made at the beginning of the experiment. Specifically, my commitment as your navigator is to plot the course of correction as Gaia herself assumes correction, as the Aeon Sophia, who is our living planet, assumes correction in real time. My commitment is to plot the course of those events. One of those events is the massive act of recapitulation she's performing since March 19th, 2012. The lunar apogee indicates divine memory. By tracking the lunar apogee through the constellations against the background of the starry constellations, the real sky zodiac, I can actually plot the course of the things that she is due to remember and recall and retrieve out of her own cosmic biography in the course of these 3 years. And so I pointed out at the beginning of the experiment that I can only know what she remembers when she remembers it. And I made a very emphatic point of saying that in January of 2012, throughout the month of January, especially around the middle of January and then going into February, would be the moment when she would recall the initial conditions she set for the divine experiment in which we are now engaged. So before that time, before January 15th, I couldn't possibly have told you what I'm going to tell you now. I engaged in 3 telestic sessions in January to investigate this phase of her recapitulation. Like a sorcerer, she is performing a ritual of recapitulation. And it begins with the very first conditions that she experienced before she left the Pleroma. Her trimorphic protanoia, that is to say, her imaginative projection of a 3-world system in which one strain of the human species would emerge and evolve, according to the terms of a particular experiment which she set up in her own mind, unilaterally, that is to say, by herself, without consulting with her consort, Thilete, who was her consort in engineering the human genome, which I now prefer to call the phenome, P-H-E-N-O-M-E, and without consulting the other aeons in the Pleroma. And so her recapitulation begins with that momentous event that occurred pre-terrestrially, certainly, and even a pre-lapsarian, to use a theological term, even before her fall or plunge. I'm delighted to report that I was able successfully to monitor her recall and to retrieve these memory features and elements, these memory elements of the very recapitulation of the wisdom goddess herself during those sessions in January. And I've been reflecting on them carefully and holding them to the best of my ability in the coherent cognitive lucidity in which I received them. And so it's from that state that I would now give you an account of these conditions. I ask you all to bring your minds back to the 9-episode synopsis of the Sophianic vision story. You can find it on metahistory.org in a couple of places. I think there are 2 versions of it. And you can find it in Not in His Image in the chapter The Fallen Goddess, beginning on page 157. Planetary biography. Those of you who live and observe this story have an absolutely unique opportunity that's not available to any other members of the human species, and I don't say that lightly. It's almost an understatement to say that. I believe that those of you who live and observe this story are coming to understand what this story actually does. I made the claim that only this story, because it is the sole coherent, complete and coherent planetary myth, only this narrative will direct your NLP to source. So, if you appreciate to some degree already the profound directive power of this myth, then I ask you to recall the 9-episode structure that I laid out initially. When I presented this structure, it was a result of about 10 years of work and countless rereadings of the mythological and cosmological materials in the Nag Hammadi texts and also in the patristic paraphrases of Gnostic cosmology, where some of the material was preserved. I worked it over ferociously and distilled it down to 9 episodes, but when I did so, I knew that these episodes were not complete. But we have to start somewhere, and it is, you must admit, a beautifully complex and complexly beautiful story. Somehow, the more you get into the complexity of it, the more simple and self-evident it becomes. I don't think the complexity of it would be off-putting to those who really see its beauty. So if you're lured in by its beauty, you can handle the complexity. You take it in, you digest and distill it, it becomes simplicity and the story lives before your eyes and you find yourself living in this myth. This is the practice of planetary tantra. So I thank all of you who have followed the 9-episode story so far. And I would like to propose to you a simple little visual exercise, a child's exercise, to instigate my recounting of the lost elements of this myth. Just imagine that those 9 episodes of the fallen goddess scenario, which I have restored from Gnostic sources, were in your hands as a parchment book. Say that the parchment leaves are quite large. They're maybe a foot wide and a couple of feet high. Large parchment leaves, stiff parchment leaves in your hand. And suppose that you hold the book at the binding and you riffle through it. So you turn the pages and there are 9 parchment pages. And on each of these parchment pages is written 1 of the 9 episodes as it has been restored to this time. Just stop for a minute and visualize that you actually have that parchment book, that thin parchment book in your hand, and that you're holding it at the seam, at the binding, and you're running your thumb over the edges and turning the pages. So you turn the first page of the parchment, and we read the story as we know it so far. Obviously, it's a very compressed and distilled version of events. Then with your thumb, you turn to the second page of the parchment. We read those events in episode 2, and to the third page. And then you come to the fourth page, and you read the events in the fourth page of the parchment, as found in the current version of Not in His Image, episode 4. Fascinated by what might happen to the Anthropos as it emerges in a world of its own, the Aeon Sophia absorbs herself in dreaming, the cosmic process of emanation. But she does so on her own, unilaterally, without a counterpart, at variance with the cosmic law of polarity by which harmony and balance are maintained in the myriad worlds. Enthralled by the possibilities of the human singularity, the Anthropos, she drifts away from the Pleroma, departs from the cosmic center, and plunges into the realm of external, swirling chaos outside the galactic core. So these are the words that are written on the fourth page of this parchment, little parchment book, which is the seed form of the Sophianic vision story. But now imagine that you're going to turn to the 5th episode. And so you put your thumb on the end of the page, put your thumb along the edge of page 4, and start to turn it. But wait, hold on a second. What is it you feel under your thumb as you press it to the edge of page 4? Well, lo and behold, there's not just one page here, but there are other pages of parchment stuck together. Previously, we thought that page 4 consisted of one sheet of the parchment, but actually, episode 4 includes other pages. Now we see what is written on these other pages. So we run our fingernail, as it were, down the edge of the parchment, and we separate the pages, and we find that for episode 4, there is not merely one page, but there are 2 or 3 more pages. Now I will read to you, or you can read over my shoulder, if you will, what is written on these hitherto 4 undiscovered pages. We find ourselves again seeing the activity in the Pleroma, in the galactic core. After the luminous template of the Anthropos had been projected outwardly to the galactic limbs and implanted in a vast nebula in the third spiral arm, M42, the Orion Nebula. And there it sits, suspended among four stars in the tight formation called the trapezium. And it hangs in a gaseous plasma medium that is nevertheless saturated with water. So it takes the form of a pattern of dewdrops on a spider's web. That is the luminous template of the Anthropos. All the aeonic powers marvel at this sight, because it is the base, or matrix, of a whole range of new experiments that will arise in planetary worlds in the spiral arms. The elder or veteran scientists slash artists of the Pleroma, the older eons, are delighted to see this experiment, which has been set in motion by some aeons among the younger members of their company. The Anthropos template was engineered by Philete and Sophia, two aeons who are relatively young compared to the other members of the Pleromic company. In parentheses, I would say the question of the relative ages of aeons is something that can be considered with great delight in another context and proves to be hilariously illuminating. In any case, there they were in the observation booth, if we might use that metaphor for the galactic core. And they watch what happens. Now bear in mind that for an aeon, 25,000 years is just a day. And so after 100,000 years, only 4 days has passed. And after 400,000 years, 16 days. And during this short period of time, from the aeonic point of view, the luminous template of the Anthropos does not merely rest passively and hang there in the Orion Nebula. Oh no, not at all. All of the aeons, including Thelete and Sophia, you can bet on it, are keenly watching the way that itself activates. How can we envision this, and how can we put ourselves, as it were, in their position to imagine, as far as humanly possible, what it is that they observed? They would have observed that the arrangement of dewdrops in a spiderweb pattern hanging in the trapezium in the Orion Nebula would have first vibrated. It would have begun to vibrate and quiver as if there were a wind blowing through a spider's web that carried a beautiful glittering pattern of the morning dew, although this dew is of a pearly luminous type, like pearl dew, and it has a distinctly amber tint, a smoky amber tint, which is actually the color you see when you look at the Orion Nebula. So they would have seen the template vibrate because it's alive, and it would have assumed between the various dewdrop points of this magnificent suspension of chemical material, because it is a chemical deposit. In this magnificent, immense suspension of chemical material, they saw points of light and shafts of light like filaments spreading from each one of these dewdrops to each other dewdrop, very much in the manner in which electrical charges and filaments and synapses in the human brain spread through the texture and the network of the brain material. But a better analogy, perhaps, would be to the formation of mycelium. Almost immediately, that is to say, in a matter of days, 4 days, 100,000 years of human time, the Anthropos template grows into a myceliated mass, and it doesn't remain simply confined to the area in which it was implanted. Long, long filaments of this mycelium begin to straggle away from the Orion Nebula, and they are picked up by the plasmic currents that flow in the galactic arms, and so they are fed outward in all directions, but mainly downstream from the arm. In all directions, these tendrils spreading from the mycelium mass take form and migrate into the galactic limbs under the beholding eyes of the pleuromic aeons. Well, of course, if you have some scientists in an observation booth and they are working with the biological material that they do not want to contaminate, for instance, a particular bacterium or a virus or some kind of living germplasm, what do? Well, they operate with their gloves in the isolation, in the manner of isolating this material, and they place it in a Petri dish, and then they sit back in their booth and they watch how it evolves in the culture in which it is placed. Well, what is the culture in which the plasm of the Anthropos is going to develop? Can only develop, it's designed as a sentient organism to develop in a planetary system. Well, what is going to provide the planetary system? The aeons themselves, note this point carefully, don't provide the planetary systems. They count on the planetary systems that continually arise by the actions in the spiral arms. Actually, today we don't really know how planetary formation occurs, nor do we know how starbirth really occurs. So we would have to put those two terms, planetary formation and starbirth, in parentheses in our imagination, not pretend that we understand them, but allow ourselves to use that syntax. There is spontaneous starbirth and planetary formation continually occurring in the galactic limbs. There is none, of course, in the pleuromic center of the galaxy. And so they allow for the arising and dissolving of these planetary habitats, and they simply stand back and watch the tendrils that are proceeding from the mycelium matrix of the Anthropos as they spread through intergalactic space and eventually seize on a planetary world in formation. Just in the same way that a tendril from a creeping plant, like a morning glory, or some other plant that climbs up a wall, will seize upon a particular niche in order to embed itself. This is exactly what the filaments of the Millennium Matrix do. And the aeons, including the Divine Sophia, who stands a little closer to the edge of the observation booth than the rest of them, she's only about 14 in aeonic terms, 14 or 15. And her consort, Thelete, is not much older. He is also a young aeon of about 20. Sophia is very excited. She stands at the edge of the observation booth and she watches the mycelium tendrils of the phenome she engineered spread along the slipstream of the third galactic limb and niche themselves in a number of planetary worlds. And so what actually happens before Sophia begins to do any unilateral dreaming about the three-body system that she would provide for the Anthropos strain, even before that happens, she and all the other aeons in the Pleroma have the opportunity to watch this phenome embed itself and come to life in a number of planetary worlds. That means that this world of ours, this planet where we are living today, is not the first planet, is not the first planetary setting in which the Anthropos deposited a strain that evolved and developed through a process of growth and adaptation to the point where it would fruit like a mushroom fruits out of the mycelium. The strains of the Anthropos template that could take root in various planetary habitats emerge from a molecular level of definition to the full definition of the five-form creature, the five-form sentient animal with the head, two arms, and two legs, the upright sentient animal. The same evolution occurs in any planetary system where a strain of the Anthropos would become embedded. And we can consider that just as a mushroom body fruits out of mycelium, so does the human body, which we have, fruit out of a mycelium molecular substrate that first implants itself in a planetary habitat. And this is what the aeons all observed. Now that we have the opportunity to peel away the missing pages of episode 4, we realize an astounding fact that before the Aeon Sophia dreamed the world that she was to become, unknowingly, the world in which we find ourselves, she had the opportunity to observe the spreading of the Anthropos strain in a number of other planetary systems. And how many exactly, I cannot say, but it was more than just 5 or 6. And just for the sake of giving it a definition, let's say that there were 8 or maybe 9. And so we would define ourselves as Anthropos 10. Just like Albert Hofmann defined the formula of LSD as LSD 26, because it was the 26th calibration of a particular chemical formula in a Petri dish, we are Anthropos 10. And preceding us in the same galactic arm where we now reside, there were 9 previous experiments involving other human strains of the same master template of the Anthropos, and Sophia observed them all with keen interest. You can bet, super keen. And the other elder aeons, who were like the veteran scientists and artists of cosmic creation, observed them as well, and so did Thelete. And what exactly did they observe from watching these 9 spontaneous events of emergence. That is the correct word. It's emergent evolution. It's not evolution as such, or simply emergence. What did they observe? Well, it might be more appropriate to ask, how did they respond to what they observed? In her recapitulation of this experience in January of 2012, the Aeon Sophia herself was able to relive her emotions. The emotions that overcame her at that time were pretty strong. This was, after all, the first experiment in the projection of an emergent sentient organism of the fivefold or pentagrammic design, which is fairly routine throughout many universes. But this was her special project, so she was keenly interested in how it was going to play out. She followed the rule of the other aeons that they would not interfere in any way by subsequent projections or emanations of their divine enoia, their intention, and their divine epinoia, their imagination. She put all her intention and imagination into the initial design of this entity, this creature, and she was happy to see how it would evolve on its own terms. But the Aeon Sophia, along with the rest of the Pleuromic Aeons, were rather amazed, and one could even say alarmed, by what they saw. Because in the observation over some millions of years, which for them would have only been weeks, they saw the mycelium spreading its filaments, taking root in planetary habitats, as if they were watching, by human comparison, a time lapse filming of a natural process, speeded up, happening very rapidly, unfolding with great rapidity before their eyes, and coming to a conclusion which they could not predict, because aeons are not omniscient. And the conclusion in each case was disastrous. The Aeon Sophia, her consort Telete, and all the Pleuromic aeons were astounded and puzzled by the behavior of this Anthropos strain in 9 distinct and different planetary habitats, because in every single case, the strain conducted itself in a most peculiar way, such that it turned against the planetary culture in which it was embedded and destroyed it. It destroyed its own environment. This is equivalent to a situation where scientists would place a bacterium, the germplasm of a living entity, with its DNA programs intact, would place it in a petri dish. We always observe the analogy of a planetary setting to a petri dish in this experiment. Suppose that scientists place the germplasm of a creature, potential creature, in a petri dish, and then they stood back and watched what it did. It mutated very rapidly. It took initial form in a molecular or microbial life form. Then it began to emerge into a more complex, articulated form with organs and limbs. Then it fruited into a complete bodily form based on the standard pentagrammic or 5-point model of a sentient creature. And then that creature turned against the substance of the Petri dish in which it was cultured. The substance of the Petri dish in such an experiment in scientific laboratories can be anything, usually something very simple. It can be a sugar solution. It can be agar-agar. It can be tapioca. And just imagine if a bacterium or sentient plasm was placed in such a culture in a Petri dish, and it evolved to the point where it assumed the articulation of animal form, and then it destroyed the very culture which had given rise to its own existence. This is what happened over and over again with these 9 preceding strains of the Anthropos. Well, perhaps you can imagine that this development produced quite a stir among the aeons, and there was no amount of consternation and puzzlement, but they were not afraid. You have to realize that aeons can feel no fear except in exceptional conditions such as the one that Sophia herself was later to experience. So they're very cool-headed, you know, they really are. They're cool-headed, they're witty, they're playful, they're extremely brilliant, and they're able to deal with these kind of things and to improvise based on what they see. But there are particular conditions that come into play regarding how they can respond when experiments with a sentient entity like this seem to go wrong. I mean, certainly it's bad news for the Aeon Sophia that her pet species is not going to be able to realize its full potential, which she has endowed within it with, along with her consort. It can't reach its full potential because at a certain point in its fruiting stage, when it reaches maturity, it destroys the planetary habitat in which it is embedded. Now, bear in mind, knowing the character of our outrageous wisdom goddess, that this was perhaps not the first, but the really first big experiment she'd ever been involved in. And she felt tremendously responsible for what was happening. And she became so concentrated on the problem and so baffled and absorbed by what had happened that it drew her away from the company of the other aeons. She, in a sense, you could say, became obsessed with this problem of her pet species to such an extent that it isolated her from the rest of the aeons, and she decided to try to work out in her own mind what was going on. So in order to do that, she had to perform a certain exercise, which went like this. She had to go back and consider how the Anthropos phenome was calibrated. Now that means that when she and Teletai worked together, they were like two scientists working in a laboratory with a massive test tube. And into this test tube, they were putting various ingredients, which are live organic ingredients, because at the center of the galaxy, everything is organic to a high degree of organic life, alive, super alive, super vital, but it consists of the radiant essences of vitality and not of any particular discrete living forms, because discrete living forms as such, animals and creatures of any kind, even microbial life, cannot exist at that level of intensity. But the radiant seeds and potentials of all life forms do exist. And these are the chemicals of life that Thelete and Sophia combined and dosed and put into the master calibration of the Anthropos phenome. So she went back and reviewed how she had done that, but she didn't do it with him, because the myth says that she dreamed unilaterally, and we can sort of understand why. In a certain respect, being such a young Aeon, she didn't want to rely on the older advice of the older Aeons. She was outrageous and independent. And at the same time, she took very, very strong responsibility for the problem with this experiment. And so she took it upon herself to solve it by herself. Now, you might find it fascinating to know. If you don't find it fascinating, then you certainly have serious mental disability. To know that this calibration of our genome made in the galactic core by the divine Sophia and her consort was entirely material. So even though the materials of chemical and molecular life as we know it here on the planet do not exist in the same form in the galactic core, you could say that the archetypes of those chemical elements exist as living realities in the minds of the Aeons. And so they could mix the archetypal components of our genome together exactly as if they were mixing material components together, chemical components. So the divine Sophia calibrated the chemical components of our genome in this manner. The base substrate of the genome was NuSe, which we know as nucleic acid. Within this substrate of NuSe, which is the basis of genetic transmission and living sentient intelligence in all the world's systems of our galaxy, within this substrate, they deposited a number of other specifically calibrated chemicals. The second one being dianoia. Dianoia is both a capacity and a chemical archetype, which, when it is released outside the pleuromic core, produces by spontaneous emergence the actual chemical to which it corresponds. So the capacity of dianoia, which is communication and language that was endowed in us, has the chemical component of serotonin and dopamine when it manifests in the galactic limbs. So out of the substrate of NuSe, which is the divine intelligence itself, we know this, right? The substrate of divine intelligence endowed in us by the gods, not to make us divine in some kind of entity, but to endow us with a divine faculty, they give us NuSe, which manifests as nucleic acid. And then into the substrate of nucleic acid, they dose other components, the second one being dianoia, manifesting as serotonin and dopamine, the third one being metanoia, and the chemical correlate to metanoia, which is the capacity to build paradigms, construct paradigms, and then melt out of those paradigms into other paradigms to grow through the process of constructing mental paradigms. The chemical correlate to metanoia is DMT. Then there was a fourth component. Now, the memory of the function of this component is a critical, critical process in Sophia's recapitulation. Until now, I have not spoken of this fourth component. I knew of it since about the summer of 2011, since I would say about August of 2011. I knew about it through conversations with Kundry. But I have not been able to understand its critical role until I followed Sophia's recapitulation in January, and I saw how deeply she was concerned with this fourth component. What we actually rightfully ought to call this fourth component is paranoia. But unfortunately, the word paranoia is terribly tainted. And so I'm going to suggest the word paranoia, P-E-R-I-N-O-I-A, paranoia, as may remind you of the term by Stan Grof, perinatal, P-E-R-I-natal. I'm not going to explain in depth what that term means right now, except to say that in her recapitulation, as I tracked it, Sophia realized that this was a very critical component that contributed to the experiments ending in the way that they did by the anthropos strain turning against its own environment. Paranoia relates to the capacity, it is the basis of the capacity of human beings to play and pretend. It is the ludic capacity. And the chemical components in nature and in the human body correlated to this capacity are the endorphins, which are present in nature as well as in the human body. For instance, dolphins have endorphins, and many animals have endorphins. Otters have endorphins, and the stronger they have endorphins, the more they like to play. So, to recapitulate, upon the substrate of nous, which is substantially and materially nucleic acid, Sophia and Thelete calibrated three other ingredients, the dianoia, the metanoia, and the perinoia, which are capacities of the human animal, and they have exact chemical correlates. Then they added a fifth element, which is correlating to the enthymesis, or the enthusiasm of the divine beings themselves. It's a general quality of the divine beings, and we call it eros. Now, the material and physiological organic correlate to eros in the human body is quite complex, but generally speaking, it consists of a couple of components. First of all, the iron radiation field based upon the hemoglobin in the bloodstream. And secondly, the circulation of the lymphatic fluids and the electrolytes connected with the function of the heart. So you can see that in the way that Thelete and Sophia, acting as divine chemists or divine alchemists, if you will, you can see that in every single detail of the manner in which they formed our endowment in a pre-physical mode, in a mode of higher physics, every single factor of their calibrations is materially present in the chemistry of life and in the chemistry of consciousness that we experience as sentient beings. Sophia remembered this in close detail, in much greater detail than I'm giving you now, because this is just a sketch, my friends. She remembered very carefully and reviewed how she went over the calibration like a scientist going over her notes to figure out what there could have been in the way that the anthropos was calibrated that could cause it at a certain critical point when it just comes to the full flowering of its sentient maturity, as it were, its creaturely maturity, to turn against the culture that has allowed it to reach that stage. What could that possibly be? And as I said, she noted very carefully that the factor of paranoia, or the ludic ability, had something to do with this catastrophic turn of events. But that was not really the key factor, so she continued to look. Now, there are two other features of the calibration of the Anthropos that were extremely critical for the Aeon Sophia. When she and Thelete had gotten to this stage of the chemical combination of these four elements upon the substrate of nous, which is nucleic acid, they reached a critical phase in the engineering of the human genome, or phenome. What I shall do right now is describe that critical phase, which will bring this recording to about 55 minutes or an hour. And then in part two, I will go into further detail regarding my findings in January. Although the Aeonic gods do not reproduce any creature of any kind by the equivalent of biological reproduction, and although they do not imprint any creatures that they design with their own image, according to that perverse lie of religion, they do invest some part of themselves in the calibration of these experiences with sentient life. That is to say, they do impart some part of their own character, and this is called the signature of the Aeon. So they gave their signature to the Anthropos serum, as it were. Once they had established these four elements, dianoia, metanoia, perinoia, and enthymesis, they came to the moment that was critical in their engineering process, whereas they really had to balance their two forces. And acting in consort, Thelete imparted a certain measure of his own aeonic characteristics, his own signature, because each of the aeons is infinitely individualized to a degree that is inconceivable to human thinking. They are complex singularities in their own right who have very particular signatures. I've talked about this before, and in the beginning of my discussion of practices in the mystery school some years back, I pointed out that the initiates could hear through hypertonicity or clairaudience, they could hear the signatures of certain aeons in the pleuromic core. So both of these aeons imparted a dose of their own signature essence to the Anthropos. Thelete, and how do we know what that was? We know from the way that they are named. The way that these aeons are named is just a syntax clue to what their dynamic properties are. Thelete means the intended, but we would translate that really into, say, free will. Because what is free will? Well, it's whatever is intended. So Thelete means what is intended, that is free will. And so the signature of Thelete was a dose of free will, or what I must call, to be accurate regarding what it is that I investigated, conative latitude. Conative latitude means that the creature who possesses the signature of Thelete will have a lot of freedom from its instinctual programs, from the divine features that define its behavior, define its capacities. It will have enormous freedom within those capacities. This is called conative latitude. Conative meaning actional, what you do by action. And that is the signature of Thelete that was imparted to us. On her hand, balancing that out, the divine Sophia imparted a dose of her own signature, which is wisdom. And this has to be called to fit the exact syntax of the vision. Cognitive apprehension, or what is also called in the language of psychology, proprioception. What this means, cognitive apprehension, means that you can learn things, you can know a lot. You don't just apprehend, but you know what you're apprehending. So the difference between us and other animals is that, you know, groundhogs and worms and monarch butterflies can apprehend an enormous amount of things. They have the ability through their sensorial design and through the divine intelligence that Sophia has invested into them, endowed into them, I should say, they have the ability to apprehend the world around them. My cats apprehend the world around them magnificently, but they do not have the scope of cognitive apprehension that allows them to be what is called proprioceptive, which means that you can build what you apprehend and scale it and build one apprehension upon the other. And to boil it down to simple terms, this means that we have fantastic learning capacity. This is the superdose we received from the Aeon Sophia herself. So into the calibrations of the Anthropos serum or template went a superdose of thelete, cognitive latitude, and a superdose from Sophia, cognitive apprehension. And as Sophia recalled this process by which she engineered our species, according to these precise determinants, she realized, ah, that's when I knew what had gone wrong. That's when I knew what caused this species to turn against the environment. She realized that she and Stelete had overdosed us with their signatures. She realized that in the total calibration of the genome, the presence of those two capacities, the cognitive and the cognitive aspects, which so mark our species and so distinguish us from other animals, were disproportionately strong relative to the five other elements. And she realized as well, and bear this in mind, very, very carefully, that this superdose or overdose played in a critical manner upon the fourth element of calibration, the paranoia factor of play and pretending. And due to the interaction that occurred between those capacities, the tendency arose, the possibility arose, for the Anthropos to behave in the self-destructive manner that the Aeons observed. It destroyed itself by destroying the culture or habitat in which it could thrive. Such it was that Sophia and the Aeons observed. But Sophia herself was more engaged, more overwhelmed in a way by what she saw than the elder Aeons, and even then by her slightly older counterpart. And in the second recording on the initial conditions of the divine experiment, we will consider what she chose to do when she realized what was going wrong with all planetary experiments with the Anthropos strain, and how she devised in her own mind, unilaterally, a solution to that catastrophic outcome.